Thank you all for coming today. And not to take Susan's thunder away, what as I go through this briefing, and I think it's in your briefing package, if you want to follow along with it, probably would be helpful. Looks like this. I'll be giving you an overview of ERA, and as Susan said, David and Sam will go into more detail about the two increments that we have already deployed and are in place, and then I'll talk a little bit about the future increments as well. So if you go to page two of the briefing, let me start out by talking about what the Electronic Records Archives is. The Electronic Archives is NARA's major IT system to solve the problem of how we will preserve and provide access to electronic records over time. Basically, the functions that are within the system are it will provide a workflow for us to deal to work with federal agencies in scheduling electronic records, and scheduling is the legal agreement that the National Archives, that the Archives of the United States, has with agencies in order to determine how long federal records should be kept. About 2% of all of the federal records that that come to the National Archive are determined to be permanent records. The primary function of ERA will be to preserve those permanent electronic records as well as provide as to ensure that we can provide access to those records. In addition, one of the driving principles of the system is that, as you all know, in terms of your own work on your own personal computers, as hardware and software changes over time, the challenge of building the system is that we have to create a system that's modular and flexible so that we can deal with different computer formats over time and can continue to provide access. I brought this little example. I don't know how many of you have these sitting in your desk that don't work on your computers anymore with data that's probably in WordPerfect 5.2, everybody's favorite word processing package, that just don't work and that you can't get in, that you can't access anymore. So the challenge that we have is to get those, to get records into the agency and ensure that over time we can keep reading the information that we receive, and of course provide access to all of you as citizens. If you go to page three, why is ERA needed? Basically to support NARA's mission. Our job is to make sure that government records are available for the future. As all of you know, in a democracy, it is important that we keep a record of the actions of the federal government, and also many of the records that we keep help to ensure that your rights as citizens and our rights as citizens are protected. So what ERA will do is help us, as I said, capture, preserve, and provide access to those records over time. And in addition, help us work with agencies so that we make sure that we do get all of those records that are created. And that actually is quite important as well. If you look at page four, this is just a quick overview of ERA. As Susan pointed out, Sean Murphy here today is here today from Lockheed Martin, and Lockheed is our development contractor for this major IT acquisition. The first RFP went out for the acquisition in December of 2003. In August 2004, we awarded a contract to two companies, Lockheed Martin and Harris Corporation, and there was a competition in terms of creating a design for the system. Lockheed won that competition, and our initial rollout of Increment 1, we call it initial operating capability, was actually rolled out in June of 2008. And the system is being built in five increments. Each increment is about a year, and if you go to the next page, this is where we are today. We call Increment 1 the ERA-based system. The focus of ERA was on federal records, and it includes the business processes for transferring, allowing us to validate the records that we receive, and as well as providing safe storage for those records within ERA. Increment two, while I haven't mentioned presidential records, we also are responsible for preserving and providing access to presidential records. So, and we receive the presidential records at the end of the administration. Sam will get into more detail about the legal requirements, but increment two provided the capability for us to rapidly ingest the records from the Bush 43 administration and to provide search capability to those users who have legal rights to look at those records at this time. Increment three is the increment that we've just begun, and there are five bullets related to what we'll be doing in increment three. I'll highlight two of them right now, but talk more about the others. The two that are of most interest to many of our constituents is first, public access. I'll talk more about this, about how we're going to be redesigning our website to take advantage of the capabilities of ERA and to improve access to all of our holdings. And the second point that I'd like to address right now is also we have some responsibility for congressional records. So we'll be working on a congressional instance of ERA to support congressional committees. If you go to the next page, this is a lot of words and a lot of pictures on a page, but I just want to quickly walk through this with you. This is full operating capability. We're often asked, as you can imagine, especially by people who are interested in our budget, about what is full operating capability and when you will be done. This page actually represents all of the functions that will be in the system when we will declare that we were at full operating capability. One of the challenges of the system, though, as I mentioned, is even though we will have all of the functions that we need to provide that will help us do our mission, the one challenge of the system is that we will have to keep changing things. How we ingest records, the IT components that we create to ingest records will have to change over time, because the records themselves will be changing in terms of format. And we have to be prepared for both hardware and software migration strategies, depending on the software formats that we receive. And the second piece of that is we also have to evolve the system to make sure that we can continue to provide access. One very simple example of that is you've all seen how the web has changed over the past few years. We have to be able to have a website that changes over time, allows us to provide access to new kinds of records, and to be accountable to our customers. So that's just one small example. But on the back end, we have how will we ingest those records into the system and make sure that we can provide that access. So let me walk through this picture with you. At the top of the slide in the blue is something we call workflow management, and that really is the creation of workflow and collaboration tools for us to work with agencies, so that it will give us better capabilities to know when records are coming in, greater reporting capabilities, and also will help us work with agencies in a more interactive manner. If you look on the left side of the chart, where the accessioning workbench is, down the side of the page, you can see all of the types of records that we expect to be able to ingest into the system. We'll get records from federal agencies, Congress, Supreme Court. The fourth bullet there is our legacy systems. We've actually been accessioning or taking in for preservation our permanent records, electronic records, since about 1969. So we already have a collection of electronic records, and many of those are available online within a system that we call AAD, Access to Archival Databases, that's currently available on our web. But one of the goals of public access will be to take that and make it part of our greater collection. We also have presidential records that I mentioned, and we'll also be able to take donor collections as we might receive them. Once those records come to us, the accessioning workbench is really about all about the archivist working with the records. The system will read the digital media, accept the legal transfer of the records in an automated fashion. The system with the archivist, the human being working with the system, will do verification that the transfers are indeed, that we did actually get the right thing. And you might think that that's a small thing, but it really isn't. When we get electronic collections today, the verification and working with the agency is actually, in some cases, takes quite a long time to make sure that we indeed do receive what the agency said that they were sending. Then we will take information about those records and do descriptions to support the access for the customer. And where required, we will transform those records to make sure that they're still authentic, but be accessible. A good example, and Sam might talk a little bit more about this, is with the email that we received from the Bush administration. It was in Microsoft format, but we moved that to a more open format to support search. In the middle of this picture is the repository, which is the core of ERA. In it, we will keep an original of all of the records, make a copy, which will be stored off-site, and there will be metadata about the collection so that we understand what we have over time. Where required, we will transform the records for access. And we will also have a classified version of ERA in the future, since there are also many classified permanent records. If you start on the right side of the picture, you can see the reference workbench. You should, when you think about this is really getting access to the system. The people who would be using this are the public, users. Our archivists and other users within the National Archives who might be supporting the researcher, as well as federal agencies who would need access to the system. If you think of the reference workbench as a really good experience in terms of using a website, the system will provide the capability to find records, present the records, and produce versions as you need them. In the future, we see the capability that someone in the public might come to our website and create their own small archive to do research and so forth, and thus producing special versions. And then where required, the little box here called Quarantine of Sensitive Content is actually the workflow that was required in particular for the presidential records, because oftentimes there is a possibility that when we receive records that are not classified, we might come across one that indeed is marked that we would have to get out of the collection. This capability is to provide the capability to track how we have handled that sensitive material. And over time, the system will also provide with the classified instance the capability to redact records so that we can make those redacted records available. What have we accomplished to date? I'll do the first bullet. The production system itself is in a data center at Allegheny Ballistics Lab in Rocket Center, West Virginia. We are up and running, and now I'm going to turn it over to David to talk about the federal records in the base system of Increment 1.
Okay. Thanks, Martha. As you saw a couple of slides ago when Martha was working you through that rather complex diagram with the different silos on it, when you think about ERA as a system, it basically, at the very simplest level, it does three things. We take records in, we preserve them, we take records out for reference purposes. So in Increment 1, our focus is on federal records, that is, records coming from federal agencies. Sam will talk about presidential in a second. That's what we've worked on in Increment 1. And the major focus was getting records in. And when we get records in, we're talking about scheduling, appraisal, and accessioning. And I'm going to talk to you about that in just a second. The other thing we focused on was base level preservation. In other words, preserving the basic bytes that come in. So if you give us a PDF file, we preserve it as a PDF file. We give you back a PDF file. But the more complex transformations that we're going to be doing later are not available in ERA right now. That's going to be done in increment 3 and increment 4, as Martha will tell you in just a moment. A little froggy this morning, sorry. And then finally, we can do some base level searching, but mostly that searching is limited to people within NARA and not public searching. That will come along in increment 3. And Martha's going to tell you more about that as well. So, you probably should turn to slide 4 because that gives you a graphical illustration of what we're going to be doing, what I'm going to be talking about.
Slide 8.
Sorry, wrong slide package. Thank you. Okay, so to get things in, you can't just stick them in. This isn't like a shared drive back at work where anybody can put it in and anybody can take it out and anybody can move it around and delete it and do all of that. This is an archives. It's not a shared drive. The difference is very important because for us, when we bring things in, we must have the metadata associated with it. Metadata like who created it, when they created it, under what circumstances they created it, and we save that not just for a couple of days, like perhaps you might, but in fact for all time. So we really have to nail that down very, very carefully. So the first part of this process, before you can get it in, is you have to schedule it. All federal records coming from federal agencies have to be scheduled through the federal records scheduling system. Right now, that's being done with a paper form called a standard form 115, in which the agency inventories all of its record series, sends it to NARA, and then NARA reviews the proposed disposition, the disposition being either temporary or permanent, and if temporary, for how many years it's supposed to be kept before it's destroyed. That whole process through ERA Increment 1 has been automated. So no longer do we have a form which is filled out with one of these. It's instead, or with a typewriter, or, God help us, with a fillable PDF file. Instead, it's completed online in a database that captures all that information. Now, that's very important for us because down the road, as we use this more and more often, then we can use that information to help us down the road as we describe the records. We don't have to retype that information or, God help us, look it up in a series of file cabinets that live on the second floor of our building in A2. That doesn't help an archivist who is working out at Laguna Niguel in California. It's not too helpful. But if we get it in one repository, then all of our archivists can have access to that. And when we get this entirely done, then the public can also look at it. And the public can also can see the, how we're, federal agencies and NARA have agreed to disposition federal records across all agencies. And if an agency has a new series of records that it wants to schedule this afternoon, they can look it up like it's a library and see how somebody else did it. If they're in the Corps of Engineers, they can see, well, geez, the Forest Service has something just like that, or perhaps Customs Bureau or whatever, and they can see, well, they called them 5-year temporary records. We should probably do the same. So it can help. There's a lot of efficiencies to be realized through this. That has been automated, and it's being used by our pilot agencies right now. It hasn't been deployed to the entire federal government, but I'm going to talk to you a bit about, more about that on the next page. So that's the first step, is we have to establish authority to put things in because you can't just shove it in, okay? Then the next step in the process is, once you've got them scheduled, then blocks of records come due to be sent to NARA, permanent records. When the permanent records are due, they come over in an accession document. Currently, it's called the Standard Form 258, and it's signed by the agency head saying offering legal custody of the records to NARA, and then it's signed by us accepting that offer of legal custody. That's how most of the records in this building are here. That's the legal arrangement under which they have arrived here. That Standard Form 258 is filled out by this powerful instrument right here, as well as a typewriter or whatever, but we've automated that as well with ERA. And with the automation of those two forms, that applies not just to electronic records, but to records of any format, that being still photography, moving images, cartographic materials, textual, hard copy paper, whatever. will use those two forms in the future. They have been built. They are being used right now by us and our four pilot agencies. The next bullet I have is it enables agencies to send electronic records to NARA. We've developed for the agencies a tool called the packaging tool. If you can think about Windows Explorer window, in which you have your file servers listed on the left and a blank pane on the right, you set up a transfer that you want to send to NARA of electronic records, and you take that and you drag and drop it over to the right side. Then you hit a button called Build, and then the Build packages the records, and what it does is it puts an integrity seal around all of the records, an integrity seal around the entire package. It adds a transfer manifest, which tells us all of the files that are in the records and the byte count for each one of them, and then it zips the file. Then agency would use their own software, like SFTP, Secure File Transfer Protocol, and send it to what Martha just said, our facility out at Rocket Center, West Virginia. They send it over the wire, or they could copy and put it onto media and put it in the mail and send it that way. But however it gets there, it gets out to our facility in Rocket Center. They then unpackage the document, check the file transfer, the transfer manifest against what they actually received. They do a virus check on it. If necessary, they do a security scan check on it. They check the integrity seals to make sure the integrity seals have remained intact and therefore the documents have been uncorrupted through the process of transfer. And then they move them from that area, which we call ingest working storage, to the archives itself, which we sometimes call managed storage. In other words, now you're into the archives itself. That obviously applies just to electronic records. And then another thing that we've built in Increment 1 is a capability, which we've never had up to this time, to record any discrepancies that take place with respect to the transfer. I know this is going to be hard for you to believe, but people make mistakes. And they tell you that they're going to send you 100 boxes, and instead, when you count them up on the loading dock, there's 99. And so box 14 went astray someplace along the road. And so then, of course, that means we've got to call up the agency and say, hey, we never did get 14. Oh, yes, you did. We sent it. And then you can figure out how that works. It goes back and forth from there. But at this point, what we do is we record that incident on the standard form 258, and we use this powerful instrument right here, and we write it in the margin there that says box 14 missing. But right now, we have developed in ERA something called the Transfer Processing Report, and it's a report by our transfer processing staff in which they put down any discrepancies they find with the transfer. A box is missing. The byte count doesn't match. You've used the wrong schedule item to send it here. It's a correct schedule, but it's not the one for these. You know, there's about 10 or 12 different common discrepancies we bump into, and, of course, the ubiquitous other. And so we can record that there, and then we can record the back and forth between us and the agency in trying to resolve the problem. It gives us a place to put that, and then, therefore, we can file that, and people, again, don't have to look in that file cabinet. They can, again, look online in ERA and find out the status or the situation with any of these transfers. Oftentimes these transfers are closed with that discrepancy intact, and we just acknowledge that they never did find that box. And so then what happens, lo and behold, 5 years from now, they suddenly find it in somebody's office and they send it to us. It gives us a way electronically to catch up with that instead of using this powerful instrument right here. We don't use that. We use the computer instead. So that's very helpful to us, and that is the next bullet. And then finally, for each of the records that we take in and for each of the business objects that we create, these different forms, an asset catalog entry is developed. And the asset catalog entry has certain metadata about the business object or record, which allows us to index on that and allows us to find it much more efficiently. So that's all been built in Increment 1, and that all is functioning right now. And if you'll turn to slide, keep my number straight here. Number 9. Okay, so you've built all these tools. What are you doing with them? And this slide is meant to answer that question. As of the end of last week, we've ingested approximately 67 gigabytes of material, and those materials have come from three basic sources. One, it's us. We are ingesting, as Martha said, we've been collecting electronic records from agencies since 1969. So our goal is to put all of that stuff in ERA. It's easier for us to manage. It's easier for us to deal with. And so we're beginning that process. And the first wave of that should be done in June of 2010. And that should include all of our materials, with the exception of our classified or sensitive materials, will be in ERA by June 2010. So part of that 67 gigabytes, or most of it, actually comes from us. The other portions of it come from federal agencies. We have four pilot agencies, which are listed on the page. They've been sending us materials, and so part of that comes from them. And the third part of it is we have decided that each time we get electronic materials from other agencies, we will act as if we were their agency, and we will enter the materials into ERA so we can start using the tools, start seeing where the tools work well and don't work well, and if they don't work well, filing defect reports with our friends at Lockheed to say we've got to make this work a little bit better, and that sort of thing. And so I've got the lists of the numbers of transactions that we've done in ERA for about approximately the last year. I'm not going to read the numbers, but you can see them there. And then, as I mentioned, we have four pilot agencies. Their names are listed there. And again, I'm not going to read those for you, but that's who we've been working with up to this point. And so I want to get to the bottom bullet on that page, which is, so our next step is to go out to do work with more pilot agencies. We want to add about 25 additional pilot agencies, small ones, large ones, cabinet-level ones, independent ones, and we want to exercise different parts of the system. Agencies that will work with us with scheduling, for example. Agencies that will be willing to transfer electronic materials. Agencies that are willing to, again, using ERA, to transfer paper, cartographic, photographic, moving images, the whole range of materials we have, so we can thoroughly exercise the system, and so we can learn from that. And then, again, we can file reports with Lockheed Martin to say, geez, we need to fix it in this way and that way to try to make the system a lot more effective. So part of our pilot test is to test the functionality, test web-based learning. We're going to do our learning of the application in a web-based fashion. And finally, to test the procedure by which an agency goes from a non-player to a player in ERA. There are some hoops that have to be gone through there, and we want to try to make that a lot more efficient than it currently is. Then the next step in the process, probably next summer sometime, we will invite any agency that wants to play to play. So that's kind of the voluntary phase. And then finally, in 2011, we're going to make it mandatory. So no longer will we be playing in paper. We will be doing all of our scheduling and transferring by using ERA. And so that's the deal with the federal side. Sam, how are we doing on the presidential side?
Well, the framework that David has talked about in terms of requirements for record schedules, the appraisal process, that you have to have these authorities in place before you transfer records into the National Archives and the Archives accepts custody for them, is a very different framework than the world in which we live. We take in records from presidential administrations under the Presidential Records Act, which was passed in the 70s and intended to be a records preservation act, and that any material that documents the constitutional, statutory, or ceremonial duties of the president must be preserved by the president and goes into the legal custody of the National Archives as soon as the president leaves office. What that means for us in very basic terms is we get a lot of stuff in terms of paper records, audiovisual holdings, and increasingly electronic holdings. What it also means is that we take on the requirement to provide access to those holdings from day one, that we have physical custody of many cases for these materials. Under the Presidential Records Act, there's a 5-year period where public access is not so much of an issue, but we are obligated to provide access to a series of bodies who have rights to gain access to these materials, including the former president, the current president, congressional committees, and any courts of competent jurisdiction who issue a subpoena to the National Archives. We have to search our holdings for any materials that respond to their requests. We have to review those materials to make sure they're actually responsive to the request. And because former presidents and the current president maintain the right to claim executive privilege over any item in our legal custody that belongs to those presidential record sets, we have to ensure that any potential restrictions have been applied to these records before we provide them to these special access requesters that we call them. Anything that we provide to special access requesters isn't then also available for public access, which means that we do a lot of work in these first few years, including all the work we've done in the system, for no apparent public benefit other than we've fulfilled our requirements under the Presidential Records Act to provide access to these holdings to the organizations who do have the right to claim requests for these material. And so what it meant from a system design standpoint was in the years leading up to the end of the administration, we knew there was going to be a mountain of data. And you see some of the figures at the bottom. We knew it was going to be a minimum of 50 terabytes, maybe as much as 100 terabytes of stuff. That is more than all the presidential electronic holdings combined beforehand. It's more than all the electronic holdings ever accessioned by the National Archives since we began accepting electronic records in 1969. We knew this was going to be a lot of material. We don't have a record scheduling and appraisal process at the beginning, so we're going to getting these things under a fairly short process. And from day one, starting January 20, 2009, we were subject to these requests under special access to search these holdings. So we talk about the different functionalities here, and these are some of the key points that drove the design of this increment of the system that are very different from what was featured in BASE. One is the rapid ingest of these holdings. It's one thing to say you're going to receive 50 to 100 terabytes of material, but how quickly you can get these materials into a system, have them indexed, and have them available for internal search is a key driver that determines your success or failure. If we were loading these things from media, we would still be somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe gigabytes at this point, rather than all the work we have left to do. So we had to find a way to transfer these holdings in a large volume at a given time. And so working with our Lockheed partners, working with the White House, we settled on a means of setting up transfer storage arrays that move these materials in terabytes at a time and millions of files at a time, rather than through an FTP process or a write-to-media process, which worked in earlier administrations. The transformation of proprietary data speaks to our need to move material from proprietary systems owned and operated by the White House. Their document management system was part of a commercial application that had proprietary rights around the way that data was handled. Their photo database was in a very similar way. We need to get these things out of those proprietary systems to preserve the content as well as the metadata and have them both searchable in the short term and available for any future transformation processes we need to do to keep these records available as time moves on, so we're not stuck with the equivalent of the 3.5-inch disk drive. So what we were able to do was working with the White House to find ways to extract data from these proprietary systems, move the metadata into XML, preserve the content, which speaks to things like PDFs for scanned documents or the JPEGs and raw images from the photo database, and have that metadata associated with the appropriate images and other content that came over in these systems. Our archivists started meeting with the system owners for the various prioritized White House systems that we knew we would need access to back in the fall and summer of last year, say, how are you using the data? What are you doing when you create the data? What sort of forms are you using? Because we have to take on the ability to understand how they created, maintained, and used those records, because we're going to be providing records along a very similar basis. In other words, if they have certain metadata they use to record information about a photo, we need to know what those fields are. Are they text fields? Are they number fields? Because that's going to inform how we can bring in those records, index them, and make them searchable down the road. So we began a very intensive process with them of determining how these records were used so that from the earliest point possible, we could search for them in a fairly informed manner. And that speaks to the next point, which is the simple search and access retrieval. It means basically keyword searching of all of the content that's available in our archive. We all know that searching has moved beyond the simple search for character strings and the simple application of Boolean logic. But at a minimum, we have to be able to search the content for the hundreds of millions and tens of millions of email messages. We have to search the metadata associated with things like the photo database, the president's daily diary, the access control systems from the White House. We have to be able to find these things using the sort of character strings that are found in those data. We have to be able to search also the attachments to the emails, any of the word processing documents, any of those other forms that they've moved information around through their emails. We have to be able to find those documents as well. And so what we have is the ability, when these things are loaded, when these records are loaded into the system, they're indexed upon loading and available for searching as soon as they reside in the archive. So even as records are being loaded in, say a set of records is only halfway through the loading, the first set that are now in the long-term storage have been indexed, they're available for search, and we can begin to pick up our custodial responsibility basically as soon as the ones and zeros settle in to the archive side of the system. We also have to have, for the first time, what Martha mentioned earlier in terms of spillage management. We're talking about hundreds of millions of information transactions going back and forth in these systems, and there is the likelihood that there is unmarked classified information residing in some of these files. It's incumbent upon our archivists to be able to recognize that data when they see it, regardless of whether there's a security marking. And we have to have in the system a technical means to isolate that material from other staff access and begin the remediation process with our equity holders who control the information it's classified, to begin to get this information out of this unclassified system as quickly as possible. So this is the first time in the system, and it's going to be a requirement moving forward with every other increment, that you can isolate something that's in question until the remediation process is done. The special access review case management is just a wordy way of saying that as archivists, we have to be able to search these records, we have to be able to find a set of records that are responsive to a defensible set of search terms, and we have to decide things about those individual records. Is this email responsive to the subpoena? If so, can we release it under the terms that have been agreed upon with this particular subpoena? Is the former president going to claim privilege over this material? Do we have to highlight it for those reasons? So within the system, we have the ability to save the search results, to capture archival decisions like responsiveness on the individual record level, and as well the releasability decision associated with those individual records. This helps us in the short term meet our requirements to answer the special access request, and it's a critical baseline of capability that we'll build on for later Freedom of Information Act processing, which after the five-year period, all of these hundreds of millions of objects, all of these terabytes, become subject to FOIA requests. And so we have to have in the system the ability for an archivist to make a decision, to capture it in an automated way, and for the system to generate output, whether on a web screen or in a write-off to media if the researcher wants it, the things that are supposed to be open and withhold the things basically that are supposed to be closed. Access control also speaks to a capability within the system that we have to have going forward as we build any other increment, which is that the archivists who have the access to the George W. Bush presidential holdings have access only to those holdings, not to any other presidential holdings that may be maintained in the system, not to the federal holdings, which they have no rights to see on their side, and vice versa, that the federal archivists don't get access to these materials in an unauthorized or otherwise inappropriate way for us. And so this sets in the notion that within the system, archival staffs who have the appropriate access can see their records and no others. From there, you see that we're well underway with the loading of the data. The exchange email data is being loaded right now. We have well over 75 million of those emails have been loaded. When I talk about the numbers with the archival staff at the George W. Bush Library and also in the presidential material staff here, they tend to get sort of depressed when I talk about the vast numbers of things that have to be searched and produced on the individual level. I look at it as job security, and you may not see the same record twice over 20 years of work, so there's got to be something there that would make your job a little more enjoyable. But the basic point of this is we have a huge mountain of data. We have a baseline of capabilities that allow us to access these records at the individual level, which is what we need going forward. And from here, we hope to build the capabilities that will have us providing public access to these records at least the five-year time period that's obligated under the PRA. That's me.
If you go to the next page, this is just through increment two, what we have accomplished, and I won't walk through that. But if you go to the next page, which discusses increment three, this is where we are today in terms of the development of the system. We've began to look at public access. Currently on our website, we have a system called the Archival Research Catalog, which is the metadata about our holdings. And the other thing that you would find if you went to our website is that it says to you, it answers the question of why everything isn't online. To date, we have about 8 billion objects, I'll call them, within the archives. That includes the paper, film, audio, and electronic records. I'm going to say it's going to be pretty much impossible to have all of that online at any point in time, at least with today's technology. So what our plan is within the ERA system is to look at how we're presenting all of our holdings online and to enrich the experience for the researchers and for the users of our system. Our plan is to try to ensure that there are two directions that a person can go when they come to the National Archives. There's what is available online, but also what is available if you decide to come into one of our facilities and do research. So we want to make it very, very clear to an individual as to where they are at our website and what the possibilities are at the National Archives. The second thing that we're very interested in doing in terms of searching our system is to ensure that the user understands first what is available online, what is available at one of our facilities, and what is available in other places. We have several partnerships where there are other entities that make our records available, And we want to ensure that the public is aware of these and that any of our holdings that started at the National Archives but are in other places, basically we want to make sure that you can access that all of that material from one place. And that isn't available today. So that is our focus going forward with public access. The second thing that we'll be working on, and perhaps the most difficult part of the system, is to begin the planning for the preservation framework. How are we going to in a very elegant way, and also in a way that we can change as we need to change and evolve as IT formats change, how are we going to ensure that we can preserve the records over time? So in Increment 3, we are going to be working on that strategy. And the fourth bullet on here that I'd like to address is the architectural evolution, because that fits with both public access and the preservation framework. When we started building the system a few years ago, we felt like we had a very, very good design in place, but IT is changing. So we are looking at open source products. We're looking at open source formats, and to see if those might be more appropriate to use within the system going forward. So we're taking another look at the architecture. The other piece that I mentioned is that we'll begin to work on a congressional instance. We hope to have something in place by January of this year. I'm sorry, of next year. That would be next year, January. And lastly, we're going to be planning for active backup and restore. While we have backup and restore within the system, as we bring on more federal agencies and as the system becomes available to the public, there's going to be a need to have the system available 24/7. So we're going to be working on the planning for a more active backup and restore strategy. The next page is just a picture of where we will be at the end of Increment 3. I just want to touch on Increment 4 and 5. What Increment 4 will be all about will be implementing the preservation capabilities, expanding access, extending base capabilities, that is, as we get more federal agencies on board, as we get to mandatory use of ERA, the system will have to grow in that manner. And at that point, we'll get the backup and restore capabilities in place, and then we'll move to Increment 5, which is, again, to just to expand use by the federal agencies, deploy a classified instance, take care of the FOIA requests that Sam talked about, and basically just extending storage, the preservation tools, and adding new technology to the system as it's needed. And we're done.
Thank you, Martha. Mm-hmm.
Everybody always has.
I was going to ask, so in terms of what is actually going to be happening in full operational capability, is that any different? Have you changed that from what you originally envisioned happening, with 2011, I guess?
Right.
And then in addition to that, what's going to happen with the records that are currently being produced that are electronic today in the electronic form? So are there any guarantees you have that those records are going to
I think the answer to the first question is that our basic core requirements have not changed. So we are pretty much still aligned to what our initial requirements were. Would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The second question.
So 2011 comes around. This
right.
Full operating capability. What's it going to mean for me or someone in, Illinois, Missouri? What are they going to be able to do? What's the actual, what's going to be at that point?
Right. I think when we get to full operating capability, certainly from an IT perspective, means that all of the functionality will be there. But to your point, one of the drivers of the system is how much data will be in the system. In 2012. So really, the records that we receive from agencies and the the more that we can provide through public access is really what somebody in Illinois will see. What our hope is that by the phased approach that we've taken with starting with four agencies, who by the way, we selected, we worked carefully to select them so that because they had very good record keeping and wanted to work with us. And then when we go to 25 agencies, as we get more and more records, we want agencies to want to use the system. So our goal here is a really, David, you can probably address this more, PR campaign.
To get to your point, somebody in Illinois or Iowa, and they log in, what's different then as opposed to right now? That's really the heart of your question. And I think what you'll see is what Martha was talking about when she was mentioning Increment 3, you'll have a unified research experience. Right now you have ARC and AAD. They're two separate systems, and there's a clumsy crosswalk between them. I'm being as generous as I possibly can for us, okay? It's not the greatest. That'll be unified. It'll be a unified experience. And also right now, as Martha's saying, we have partners helping us digitize a lot of our holdings. It's not obvious from our website where that is. So you look it up in our website, and the answer you think you get back is, I guess you don't have it. Well, we have it, but somebody else did it for us, and there's no easy way for a researcher to have that unified experience. And I think that's the thing a researcher will recognize more quickly than anything else. One-stop shopping, one portal that'll direct you to all the materials that relate to the National Archives, whether it's through this system in NARA, this system in NARA, this system in somebody else's that has done something with us. Wouldn't you say that's true?
Yeah, and I think the additional piece that I was trying to get to that I wasn't very eloquent about was as we work closer, we have more and more agencies who are putting records into the system, more and more of those records will also be available.
More stuff.
So will you be publishing guidelines for agencies to handle the records they create henceforth so that they will be more adaptable to ERA down the line?
We've been doing that up to this point. Our model is to do it format by format, and if you look on our website now, you'll see transfer guidance for how to deal with things like PDF and web and several other things. We've got six formats out there. And I'm not sure I could do them off the top of my head too quickly, so I won't quiz myself. But the point is, you know, there's no way that we can keep up with every format that exists. In NARA right now, we did a quick seat-of-the-pants inventory, and we have like about 100 formats. So does that mean we have to do 100 transfer guidance? That model doesn't scale. So what we're trying to move to is a different model whereby we provide more generic guidance on things like, and I'll just give you a couple examples. We don't have it fleshed out yet, but things like, don't send us stuff that's password protected, because you know what? We can't open it. That's not too helpful. Don't send us stuff that's encrypted. Same problem. I mean, it's stuff like that that's more generic across things. And then what we're also providing, and you'll see it on our website, is something called sustainable formats. We're encouraging agencies to send us stuff on a sustainable format, which is open source. The metadata is encapsulated with the document, and it's ubiquitous within the marketplace. Those are formats that tend to be more long-lived and are more helpful to our research community and to us. So that's the direction we're moving right now. Is that helpful?
Yes. Hi, I have two questions for Sam.
Sure.
One, in talking about Bush records, does any of the work that you're doing now inform, they're still in the planning process of the Bush Library, and I would imagine that's going to be one of the more heavily electronic libraries that's of all of them, just because it's the latest. So does the work that you are doing now inform how the library is going to look, if that's something you can speak to? And then looking ahead to the Obama administration, I can only imagine that the amount of documents that are going to come out of there is going to make, you know, Bush look like President Washington or something. But
Web 2.0, Sam.
Are you guys looking towards that? And what are you thinking about?
In terms of the first question, even at the temporary library facility in Lewisville, Texas, the archivists there have access to ERA. They're looking at the records that are available in the system. So what we have to do in moving forward to the permanent facility is ensure that at a fundamental level, the IT connectivity is there to bring in both the size of the assets and the number of transactions they're going to be doing across the network to access our data housed in West Virginia. They also have a substantial textual collection of materials. And so as you move forward with designing both research facilities and storage facilities, it's more a question of can they use their NARA IT infrastructure to access the data, which is also in a NARA IT infrastructure, and a sufficient rate of connectivity that you're not sitting there waiting for a 20-megabyte PDF to download for more than just a couple seconds, because you have a lot of other work to do besides waiting on these things to be available on your workstation, but that we also provide a means for any researcher who comes on site to look at textual records also has access to the same holdings. You can be in Illinois or Missouri and access these holdings once they're publicly available. Do we have a place on site where they can do the same thing? In terms of informing the overall library design, it's really more a question of connectivity because they're going to be able to do this as they do now from their desktops. In terms of the second question, we got a lot of stuff this time. We're going to get a lot of stuff the next time. And at the fundamental level, if we've gone from roughly 2 to 4 terabytes of Clinton material to now between 75 and 100 terabytes of Bush records, as you move forward in the Web 2.0, and now that email is more than ubiquitous, it's everything is being sent forward electronically, we have to maintain at a fundamental level the ability as we move forward in the years and know more specifically about their records that we can maintain some sense of scale to what we can build. They have between 60 and 100 gigabytes of material on the data on the federal side. We've got up to 100 terabytes on our side now. Can we build a system with a sufficiently evolved architecture that we can take on whatever the scale is going to wind up being? We know it's going to be substantially more than we have, but at this point it's sticking a finger in the wind to know it's just going to be a lot more. So we have to, as we move forward with architecture evolution activities, that we're ready for this big balloon payment, in essence, of records at whatever period he leaves office. And that's really about as informed as we can be about it at this point.
Mr. McClure, I'm wondering two things. In your presentation, you said that it was important that archivists who had access to one collection, the Bush collection, for example, not be able to have access to the collections of other presidents across there. And that's the first time I've ever heard that. Could you explain why that's important? And also, is the archives going to have any ability to work with GSA in mandating to the White House and future administrations what the shape of their document record systems are going to be? Because one of the things that emerged in congressional testimony is that over time, you have different White Houses going to different vendors and favoring one over the other for business or political reasons, and I can imagine that that creates exactly the problem that you're describing, all these different formats and proprietary systems up the wazoo. Can you address that and talk about the degree to which you're able to influence standard settings for systems at the White House?
First question I can attempt to address. The second question, our chief archival liaison to the White House and our general counsel are here. They can deal with that one in a moment. In terms of access to materials by administration, in the world that we've dealt with to date in terms of presidential records, which is the records of President Reagan forward, which are the ones that become the legal custody of the archives at the moment the president leaves office, the ones that are technically property of the government and not donated material like the earlier president's records were, the earlier presidential materials, is that former president maintains the right to claim executive privilege over his holdings. The incumbent president maintains the right to claim privilege over any of these presidential records. So the process you've set up in the traditional world is I have a library in Simi Valley, California, in College Station, Texas, in Little Rock, in Dallas, wherever. The archivists who are there are the archivists who work for that library. The Clinton archivists have access to the Clinton traditional holdings. They develop a relationship with the representative of the former president to say that when we review these materials, there are certain criteria of sensitivity that each president and former president has the right to exert over their materials. Some presidents are more sensitive about some rights they're granted under the Presidential Records Act. Others have other sensitivities. And so what you do is you ensure that the archival staff who has access to those holdings, one, is as big as we can make it, so we have enough Clinton archivists to do these things, but two, that they are the ones who are reviewing these records, and that when a representative of the former president or the current president can be assured that you have a responsible staff who's providing access to the materials in the appropriate way. The easiest way to manage that is to say, you archivists work on the George W. Bush holdings, you archivists work on the Clinton holdings. And so the way we've partitioned it in the traditional world is very easy. You're in Dallas, you're in Little Rock. At a system level, we're trying to set it up so that we have the equivalent. You can apply the resources that have access to those materials to those materials, but you don't have a situation where other archivists are getting access to these things. It also follows the principle that we have throughout the archives that those who require access to the holdings have access, and those who don't require those holdings access to those holdings don't have access to those holdings. It's a mitigation of risk, basically.
Just to clarify, is that for reasons of classification of material, control of classification?
Classification plays a role in any of the access that NARA provides to its holdings, but the basic principle is again, it's a mitigation of risk. If you can say that these are the archivists who have access to the holdings from modern military records, that you're not letting in reference archivists who deal only in microfilm holdings or records in the regional facility that have access to the same material. You control the population, and you mitigate the risk of any sort of mishandling of the material or any other sort of unauthorized access. In terms of your second question, there's our general counsel and Nancy Smith to talk about that.
General counsel and Nancy Smith, who's director of presidential materials staff. Let me just get the microphone.
I think your question was, are we going to work with GSA to provide guidance or requirements on the administration, on the White House, on how they manage their electronic records? The short answer is the PRA, the Presidential Records Act, controls records management of presidential records, and it gives the exclusive authority to the president. So the president and his staff, it's the Office of Administration and his counsel and all, they control and determine how they manage all their records, including their electronic records. We have no legal authority. GSA has no legal authority over how the president manages his own records. We do, however, give guidance to the White House and always have upon their request based on our experience and expertise and background. So we work very closely with the administration, with the Obama, with Bush 43, with every administration, and give them our best guidance, and they seek our guidance, and we're giving them what David was talking about in terms of formats and structure and all. We're passing that on to them and encouraging them to set up their systems so that when they leave office, at the end, 4 or 8 years, it'll be most easily transferable to us. And that's the best we can do. And then we work with them as transition approaches to then figure out how to, as Sam described, extract materials out of whatever proprietary systems they're using so that we can ingest it in the easiest way.
Kind of a basic question from a layperson's point of view: are we saving too much or trying to save too much? I mean, faced with if you must save 2% of this staggering amount of material, should we be trying to save 1%? At some point, do we have to say this is just too many emails?
Do you want to answer that, David? I think it's
saving?
Just right.
Yeah. Well, you've plunged into one of the deep mysteries of archiving. And it's always difficult.
Wow.
We're trying to, what the law says we're supposed to do is what materials warrant permanent preservation on behalf of the United States indefinitely. And so it's always a cost-benefit kind of calculation that you made. I would never say it's a cost-benefit thing in strict dollars and cents terms because, of course, there's cultural values involved. So one has to make those judgments on a...